Accession number 27226, reel 19.
Final hook. Start. Reel 19.
Right, are we starting a new tape? Right, well, I forgot to tell you about the Stirling Castle, because it was such a luxury trip, and it was a joy, that it was more than that. Because when we're in Freetown, of course, the two, they will come into the picture later on, two army officers were in charge of the Royal West African Frontier Force. And they were being trained, and of course we were doing shoots for them on the beach. And of course we were great pals, we all lived together in the mess. And one aspect of the trip before then, it all coming back again slowly, but as all part of the mess, we also had the local police in the mess as well. They shared our messing. And of course, leaving Freetown, you always want to take mementos of Freetown, and there was always this talk about diamonds and everything being available, and somebody approached me with a gentleman who said he had some diamonds to sell. So all as being a smart ass, I thought I'll have a look at these. I said, well, I can't buy them, and he gave me one that looked not like a normal diamond, which is pristine cut. It looked like a piece of glass. It's about an inch long, fairly square, and there were one diamond that they tried to polish and sort it out, and another one. That is the one. Those are ones I can remember, but there was a selection there. And of course, being with the police, we could talk about diamond smuggling and everything else. And I went to him and said, bloke down the road wants to sell me some diamonds. What do you think of these? He said, well, I'll look at them and check them for you. He said, no problem, Gordon. He said, we'll have a look. And he took those bloody things and brought them back. He said, they're not real diamonds. He said, I've thrown them away. I said, you silly bugger. I said, I've got to explain to this bloke what's happened to his diamonds. Well, he said, that's your problem. There's a mate of mine in the police station. So I thought, well, I'm going to see this bloke. So I thought, well, if he was selling me phony diamonds, then I've been done with phony diamonds. I'll have to make some more. So I got a piece of broken glass and a pair of pliers, crunched the glass with mud, and wrapped it up in the paper. And when this bloke came along, I said, I saw those, sir, those the police. They said they weren't proper diamonds. I said, and I'm not to have them. He said, give them back. He said, so I've given them back to you. And this bloke got four pieces of glass or three pieces of glass that I'd made as diamonds for him, which is probably flogging somebody else's diamonds. But they probably were, if the truth was known, diamonds. Because somebody, one was a rough. One was really a rough diamond that they tried to polish. And there was a facility in Freetown with amongst the Syrians. I mean, the Syrians control the economy of Freetown at that time, with food and everything else coming from the English company, the Unilever, part of Unilever. So that was one aspect of the Stirling Castle. But also, these two officers... There were two. I keep thinking there were three. There were two officers anyway, because they're the ones I can remember. Were in the West African Frontier Force. And of course, when we got on the Stirling Castle, the whole of the West African Frontier Force was on the Stirling Castle. As a troop ship, we were living in the luxury, and of course, that's the thing that personally you remember. But of course, with the boys, they all have been fed and watered and living on a ship. And it's not the first time you have native boys who've never seen a ship before. And the general opinion was, well, this was a railway train running on lines under the water, which was again reinforced on the Cade of Ishmael business, which we'll deal with later on. But these boys were all put onto the ship. Now, they were mainly Christian, but some of them Mohammedan. The food on board was in a big boiler, metal boiler, with a fire underneath it, where they did all the meat. And it was usually bully beef with very little fruit or anything else but rice. So they got beef and rice, no fruit at all worth talking about. I think they took some on board. They must have had some, but they certainly didn't have the native fruit. They didn't have any mangoes there. But the food was on the 24-hour service. They could have food all day and every day, which is something I never had. And these boys were in transit going all the way around to Burma. This is part and parcel of the move to the Far East, which, again, the closing of Simontown and the transport of a lot of native troops was it. And they used to feed them on this bully beef. And of course, there was a riot, wasn't there? Because they're not supposed to eat beef. And we had to convince them that all the stuff, all the beef that was going to there was lamb. Yeah? That was one of the simple domestic problems you'd had to deal with, mass feeding of troops. Because if you're relying for mass feeding of troops, one of the staples we provide for our troops was bully beef in all its various forms, which of course was foul stuff to Mohammedans, all Islamics at all. And of course, as soon as you got to Africa, the influence of Islam was there, and you could always find, especially in West Africa, a northern part of Nigeria, for instance, where the Nigerian boys came, was virtually all Islam, because it was a desert economy up there, and they took to Islam. So it had a problem straight away, but they had to eat, and that's what they had. And they had boiled rice and this stuff that's boiled in this can all day and every day. Now, you've got so many troops, I don't know how many, but probably 400 or 500, with nothing to do on board a ship. What do you do? They have to entertain themselves somehow. And there was a game they used to play in West Africa, which I think is called Go, where they can take stones and scoop holes in the ground and put so many stones in these holes and put them into the others, and then the other boy has a go and put them into others. And apparently it is the way they appointed the chiefs in West Africa. Have you heard this one before? And it's now available as a game, incidentally, by the way. But those boys used to sit down and watch two people playing this game day in, all the way down to Cape Town. And they were absolutely fascinated by it, cheering when something happened. And all it was three or four stones in little bowls, which they lifted up and went 1, 2, 3, and lifted up them 1, 2, 3. How they played the game, I never knew. And I made inquiries about this after the war and found out, actually, where it could be bought in the market in London. And it was explained how it was played. But they said they used it to appoint the chiefs in West Africa. And I said that's probably the reason why all the chiefs in West Africa are always very old and very skinny. But that was Go. And it's a game that now is available in this country. But you don't see them as a general game. But it was... There is a similar one where you can move things and everything else, but it kept those boys quiet all the way from West Africa to Cape Town. I don't know what happened after that, but I saw them later on, and they were different people. But that's another part of the history.
So yourself, you went to South Africa, and then you went up to Durban. And you
we set off to Durban. We did we were luxury again. We first class seats in the blue train, which ran from Cape Town through Johannesburg, didn't stop at Joburg, or if it did, we didn't notice it. And I can't remember how long it took now. Must have taken time. But we arrived in Durban to stay in a hotel overnight for onwards transition to a ship. The ship was, I can tell you later, but I'll find that in my logbook. I think I put it down. But we travelled from Durban up to Mombasa to go into the fleet fighter pool at Mackinnon Road. So we're then on another tropical cruise, luxury cruise really. But in the meantime, we stayed a couple of nights in Durban. Now, In Durban, when any of the services went to Durban, they were rightly entertained. It was the holiday resort for the Navy, and the ship goes in, marriages are done off, people are made pregnant, all sorts of nasty things, but they never went back again. And this happened to, I think, the Indomitable, where that was a sad situation where nobody could have gone back because they went out to the Far East of the Pacific. And I know that there was a lot of people did a lot of naughty things when they went ashore, and they had a ball, but it was one of the stories of wartime, really. Go to Durban, you'll have a hell of a time. What happens after that, you don't know. And that, again, takes me to another story dealing with the war as it went into the Pacific and the sinking of the Admiralty Float and Deck 4 in Ceylon later on. But that's interesting because it mentions the importance of Durban as a place where a ship could have its bottle scraped and escaped and everywhere else being there. And the only other place in that part of the world was Sydney. There was a problem. Okay? Deal with that later on. Okay? So we go on the trip. Now, we went on this boat, which was quite a jolly, to Mombasa. We drove into Mombasa. The first thing you see of Mombasa is a coastline and a lot of cliffs and a lot of trees on it. And we're going to a place called Kilindini, which is known as the deep water. It was a deep water harbour. You don't even know it's there. And we went in the ship, whose name I forget at the moment, made a dirty great dive for this dirt rock. You couldn't see anything but greenery and rock. And did a sharp right and a sharp left, and suddenly we're going down a channel between the land either side, and you went through this canal more than anything else into a big open deep water harbour. And it was very deep, as I'll tell you later. Never mind. So we've now done the journey. I can't tell you much about the journey, but I'm sure there was most funny games on board for 3 or 4 days. It was like I can't remember any aspects of it. Though there was no, it's further on. No, that does with that. We'll draw blind over that one as whatever happened. We arrived to Mombasa to be greeted by the usual sort of harbour with all the natives, shipped ashore to Colombo, to the racecourse, to wait transit to our new base, which was the Fleet Fighter Pool at Mackinnon Road in... I said Ceylon, did I? No. Mackinnon Road, which was 90 miles up the railway line to Nairobi. Miles away from nowhere, whichever way you went. So... the only thing I remember about that place was that we stayed at the aerodrome, which was rather interesting because the roads down there had houses, big houses near the airfield, and there were two houses on the front of the road, and between the two houses there'd be another house exactly the same set back behind it with the gardens and everything else. Remember that particularly because these faced on to the airport, which was now taken over by the Fleet Air Arm. We spent the first night there with some of our old pals from early training days, and I believe in West Africa. Can't remember the details there, but it's immaterial. Except that one of them, Angus McIntosh, was a pilot. And he had the habit of drinking the golden liquor that they have over there. And when we met, he got a share of it, and they was describing something about flying and everything else. And he was on the balcony of one of these houses at the back. And he took off over the balcony, you know, flying on the deck and broke his back. So what did they do? They took him away to hospital, they wrapped him up in plaster, and within 6 weeks, he was fly again with his back in plaster. unbelievable, really. I remember that, that was Angus. I met him again later on. He was still alive after the war, so he did all right. But I think they did a lot of... yeah, they stayed in East Africa in a different aspect to me. Okay, so we go to Mackinnon Road. We arrive there, and there is nothing. Everything is gone except the aeroplanes. It's now got three new pilots. It's got a lot of pilots who are still hanging around waiting to go over to Ceylon. It's got food. It's got natives. It's got airplanes. It's no flying. It's got a captain who's only interested in big game shooting. So we arrive there. And the first thing is, the accommodation is open to the weather. We're also living in tents there to start with. But the later accommodation at Mackinnon Road was improved, I suppose. But we're living in tents there, because alongside the mess with all the rest of the lads who were going to leave, and they didn't stay there very long, but while we were there it was mayhem, because with nothing to with very little food, had to shoot our own meat. If we want meat, we shot our own stuff, and every day there was no flying, and they used to go in a 20-hundred-weight desert buggy up a track to a place called Pika Pika, where the animals fed at night. It was a water hole, shooting game on the way. And we had everything on board. We had a 0.5 elephant rifle, and four tens of shotguns, 303s and anything, and shoot at anything. And we were permitted to do this because of good training, apparently, for fighter boys. I remember one thing, a little dick-dick. They used to shoot dick-dick to eat. They were like a broad, big, a small deer or a large rabbit with horns. And also, the ones with the long, those things. Right, those
gazelle.
Things. Can go
gazelle.
Pardon?
Kudu or gazelle?
Kudu, any whatever. And I always remember shooting at what a group of those. And they jumped over anything, and one had only got about two legs, I think, and he was still running, and the other two were flopping behind him. That's a silly little story, really. But that's what we did all day and every day. But somebody was selected from the assembled multitude by the captain to go to Pika Pika and stay there at night, where they'd stuck down on a stake, something that shot, in the hope that a lion could come, so he could catch a lion. I don't think he ever did. Enough of that. Pissy parties in the mess, people were drinking gin, nothing else, because that's all they could get, and there was no water, which is another story. Used to, when it was all over and done with, they have silly games like liar dice. They played liar dice all the time. Ever played liar dice? A liar dice is a set of dice with ace, king, queen, jack on the six sides. And you put these in a senior service tin, of which I've got one outside there, by the way. And you play dice with it. You can't, once the dice are in, they can't be turned over because they're in a tin-tight tin. And you play with lives. And you play as poker. You're allowed to take any number of the dice and throw them at any time. And you pass the set on, declare what's in the tin, either truthfully or dishonestly, and if you turn the truth and he says no, he loses his life, and so on. So it's the old story of liar dice and lose your knickers. Well, that was a game where you could actually fix anybody. And of course, it was drinks. It was playing for drinks all the time. So the one bloke at the end was bound to get pissed out of his mind at the end of the night. And they go off, and they chase each other round the tents. They had double-skin tents with sun awnings up the top, and then set fire to them because they weren't going to use them anymore. It was mayhem. And if you're sleeping in the tents, it wasn't a good thing sleeping in the tent, because you've got rhino, and particularly baby rhino, wandering through the tent lines, and they'd take half a ton of tents out at one hit, you know, just go along, wipe the tents out. So that was interesting from a wildlife point of view. But finally the boys went, and we were left to look after the airfield. Now, we had a crew of people. There was a care and maintenance situation. There was... we go back to West Africa because one of the boys that what did he call him? Doesn't make any matter. I'll remember his name later. He broke his arm in West Africa and he had it wrapped in plaster and he couldn't do anything else, but he could never, when he was in the mess arguing with people, he'd bang his wrist on it, he'd bang his arm. He was still there and he was the aerodrome control officer. He could drive a motorbike and he had a motorbike. And he drove around the airfield because it was open. There was no fencing all the way around. The wildlife came in. And he was still there with this arm, which had broken. He used to drive on his motorbike all over the place. And he drove up this path, which was quite a well-worn path with trucks and everything else, through trees and bushes, came around the corner on his motorbike and hit a giraffe. Have you ever seen a giraffe? Have you ever touched one? Took all his plaster off his arm, scrubbed all his arm up the side, and I saw him 6-7 months later in Ceylon, and he was still having that bandage. They couldn't get rid of the disease in his arm. His arm had mended all right, but this was still wrapped around with bandages. And if you hit a giraffe on a bike, and you're only wearing a short sleeve jacket, you've got a problem because they're made of sandpaper. You hit one and it's like it's rough as old boots. It's not a smooth silky thing that it looks like at all. So that was this laddie who was the aerodrome control officer. We had all wildlife on the airfield at night, and you never knew what was going to happen when you went for a pee. You could be walking and lying walk about the place. It was just living in the centre of Africa. They could get in. There weren't any monkeys. I don't remember any monkeys, but there must have been. No problem. We lived there for a little while, and then they decided that we flew all the aircraft back up to. We used to fly the aircraft up to McKinnon Road to Nairobi.
Oh, again, I'm at it again. And do that, yes.
To fly them again to the repair yard at Nairobi. Which again was a straightforward trip. We follow the railway line all the way up to Nairobi until you turn left. We had no problem, but it meant every day we went up there, we had a meal in the mess and flew back at night and lived there, take the next airplane up day, cleared all the airplanes. And then while we were there, there were one or two incidents which are of interest because it showed life in the raw. There were native boys who drove this 20 hundredweight desert buggy, which formed part of our life. Wherever we went, there was always a 20 hundredweight open truck or with a canvas over the top. And these boys joined the army, and in the army they got a pair of boots, which they never wore because they gave them their feet, and they hung them over the thing. And they drove up to town for whatever job they had to do. In this case, not a 200-weight desert buggy, but a water bowser. Because we had no water at McKinnon Road. We could have salt water. We could do a well down, but salt water, which washed everything brown. Salt water, soap and everything else, but nothing else. To drink, it had to come in a bowser. We hadn't any water. And that's why everybody was drinking gin. So they sent a boy down, two of them, in the truck, to go to Mombasa, to get it filled with water, the only place to get water, and come back. Now, McKinnon Road was on the main railway line. There's a main stop on the railway line. And the camp was at one side, and the way the boys lived, and the other bits and pieces were the other side. And they were always told, never, ever, to go across the railway line without stopping. See, there wasn't a train coming, and it was a long straight line both ways. In the old days, there was only two trains a day, one up and one down, taking soda from the soda lake. But now they were more frequent, the more soda wanted, there were more, so they were irregular. So the boys come back with his load of water for us to drink. It forgets the rules. It drives across the railway line at the same bloody time as the train was coming down from Nairobi. Killed him. Wrecked the water barrel, which we only had one. And we had no water. Wiped him off anyway, that was it. He was dead and done and dusted. So we had absolutely no water at all, except I think we were on to a pint a day for everybody for about 14 days. And that for everything. I had to wash and... But, and this is, I've recorded this, it's written. It is written, as they say in the Quran. They boys went down with another, got a water bowser. And, you know, honestly, they did exactly the same thing at the same time. Two water bowsers, two sets of boys, both killed, going across the railway crossing at the same time, the same place. That's why we're all drinking gin. It was unbelievable, it really was. And once you got a water bowser there, you were on short corners, because you could only... the water you had, if you had a full camp of people, get the water bowser in a day.
At that time, you mentioned earlier a few contacts you had with civilians in Kenya, some of the pilots.
Oh yes, that comes along, because when we were in Mackinnon Road, we were establishing ourselves, and the first thing we did there was the cleverest trick we ever had, was that we recognised that if you're living in tents, they have special tents and special beds. You don't sleep in the Navy on the floor ever. You get a bed. And these are beds with a spring feet that you know the ones I mean, don't you? And you fold them up, and you fold them up into a little sack. We stole six of those, we had two each, and they followed us wherever we went, and I lost mine somewhere. Somebody stole it on one of the ships. But they're always useful on board ship, because if there wasn't a cabin for you, you could always sleep in the corridor in one of these beds. Anyway, we've now done Mackinnon Road. We've gone back up, done our bits and pieces. We know where Nairobi is, we know the railway line, and we've now got our staying appointment, because we can't go to the Fleet Fighter Pool, which Godfrey Parrish has gone. He's just left us. He was there to Ceylon to start. Well, we're sent to another stooge squadron in Mombasa at Port Reitz. This meant that we're doing, again, anti-submarine patrols, work for the Navy, whatever they wanted us to do. Anti-submarine work particularly, though there was a lot of submarine activity in that part of the world, but it was not convoy work. It was Japanese submarines that were wandering around all the place all the time. And in particular, there was one, the I-27 with an aeroplane on board, which was doing the round from... I'll start off with Aden, really. It came to Aden, it hit the Aden on a certain day with Germanic precision. It came the same day, the same week, you know, and then to Mombasa, then down to Durban, and then back, presumably to a refueling depot somewhere, and back again. That's another story. But it started off, I think, at Calcutta, then down to Ceylon, then at the coast of Bombay, then round, then to Aden, and then Mombasa, and then Durban, and then back again. And that submarine was the I-27, which had an aeroplane on board, and it was doing reconnaissance to find out what was happening. And we knew when it was coming, and we picked it up on the radar, but we could never catch it. And what happened was that this pilot used to come in and see what ships were in the harbour, and then go back to his own submarine, and he was struck down very, very quickly. And we were armed with Hurricanes at that time, with two depth charges on them, two 500-pound depth charges on the Hurricane. Armed up, all set to go for when this submarine came doing his tour. More about this submarine later on, but we're aware of it. And